Happy New Year. It is Wednesday, January 1st, 2014. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
Jacqueline Froelich.
Katie Henriksen.
Christina Thomas.
Timothy Dennis.
And I'm Antoinette Grada.
And this is a special edition of Ozarks at Large, as has been the case earlier this week and will be for the rest of the week. Some of our favorite stories from 2013. Now that we've crossed the threshold and gone into 2014, we're going to continue this week. Some of our favorite stories. And Timothy Dennis, you did a three-part series this year on all the goings-on at the technical park, the
yes,
regional technical.
Yes, I did. Over the past few years, I've noticed a lot of startups have been successful at the Arkansas Research and Technology Park. And basically, it's a place where someone has an idea, they have a piece of intellectual property, and they go there and they can rent space so that they don't have to actually purchase a building and equipment and such as that. And it's a really neat place because they've got places for startups just starting out, for sort of middle-of-the-road startups who've already gotten their footing, and then startups who have graduated and have products on the market. And this piece is actually piece number two of the three-part series about the Enterprise Center at the park, and it's basically where these startups go whenever they have their products ready for market. And I talked to two startups there, one who was there since the beginning and more of a recent addition to the park. Arkansas Power Electronics International started where many tech startups in Northwest Arkansas do, in the Genesis Technology Incubator at the Arkansas Research and Technology Park. At that point in 2002, the company was operating in a 100-square-foot office and had three employees. But as the electronics packaging outfit found success in development of its products and found markets to target with those products, the company needed more space. So when the Enterprise Center at the park opened, APEI occupied 30,000 square feet of manufacturing space on the building's ground floor.
The growth of our company has kind of been very synergistic with the growth of the park, in that when the building's going up, we're already in there before it's even foundation is poured. And so it's been very nice. Things just seem to open up for us as we have a little growth spurts and things like that. I know it's been challenging sometimes to kind of keep up with our growth, but Phil Stafford has done a great job.
That's Charmella Mounts, the Director of Business Operations for APEI. We'll hear more from her and Craig Olanichek, the company's co-founder and vice president of engineering, in a few minutes. But first, as I walk into the Enterprise Center, I see a resource that apparently is as important to entrepreneurs and engineers as it is to journalists. Coffee. A Jam and Java coffee shop is located right in the lobby, allowing people working in the park to grab a quick bite of lunch or a cup of joe without having to leave the campus. Beyond the coffee shop, though, the Enterprise Center is home to five affiliates, including the Sustainability Consortium, APEI, and SFC Fluidics. Here's Phil Stafford, the executive director of the UA Technology Development Foundation, the governing body which oversees everything at the park.
Enterprise Center is the commercialization hub for the Arkansas Research and Technology Park. So once the designs of a technology have been fully optimized and they're ready for production, and this would be the place where you would come to do the production.
As I mentioned earlier, SFC Fluidics is one of those companies that is capitalizing on its products. Sai Kumar is the company's vice president of research and development. He joined the company 3 years ago.
The company has transformed from being mostly research-focused company that it was to product-focused company. So most market-driven and capitalizing on the research that has been done over a number of years.
The company's research focus is in the realm of microfluidics, or the study of microscopic fluid flow. In nature, the xylem and phloem of vascular plants, like trees, are examples of microfluidic structures, as the microscopic channels transport water and nutrients throughout the plants. But the work at SFC Fluidics is more focused on lab work than work in the forest. The company has two products already on the market, one of which is a system of snap-together connectors designed to make assembling microfluidic systems easier and to eliminate problematic leaks and air bubbles. The other is a small footprint pump designed for microfluidics and lab-on-a-chip applications. Kumar says that to bring those products to market, it took a shift in the culture of the company.
This product development transformation was primarily based on scheduling a launch of a particular product. Okay, that was the very first thing that we did. And we said, by this time, we want to put our product out there. What does it take to do that?
He says that the two products already on the market are pushing the company to other product launches as well.
We are generating some interest in the community with respect to individualized utilization of these components. And we also have come up with a kit concept. Just like you will have a Legos type of thing, if somebody wants to build something very quickly. So we are putting together this developer's kit for the microfluidics.
In addition, the company has formed a partnership to take the pump that's already on the market and customize it for drug delivery applications for a larger, unnamed company. Kumar says that with marketization, the company has come a long way since when he interviewed with the company back in 2010. At that time, it was still located in the Genesis Incubator facility, and he says the company seemed cramped into the smaller space. But things are much different now.
It would be like a Cadillac. You know, what we are in the Enterprise Center, it's very expensive. At the same time, you know, we do have adequate space. I think it's probably a little more than what we need, by 20-25% more than what we need. But it gives us a presence, and also when the customers and partners and other people visit, for the visitors, it makes a very good impression.
Speaking of space, as I mentioned earlier, Arkansas Power Electronics International has several thousand square feet of manufacturing space on the first floor of the Enterprise Center. But this isn't manufacturing like you would typically think of. Because the company manufactures high-power, high-density electronics, its manufacturing lines are located inside Class 1000 clean rooms. Clean rooms are highly controlled climates where temperature and humidity are controlled and airborne particulates are filtered out to prevent contamination in the production process. The Class 1000 designation means that there are less than 1,000 ambient particles in every cubic foot of air in the room. Phil Stafford says that APEI's transition from prototyping to manufacturing helped inspire the construction of the Enterprise Center.
As it turned out, there were a few other companies like SFC, like NN Labs and Nanomec that were also ready and in need of that kind of space. So in this case, we built a 65,000 square foot building. It was strictly core and shell. And why you see these laboratories, it was a collaborative effort between our design engineers and the design engineers, if you will, at Arkansas Power Electronics International, same is true upstairs, working together to understand exactly what kind of space they need, and then we build it out to their specifications.
That mindset of working closely with the tenants, as well as the other resources of the Research and Technology Park, have helped APEI grow over the past decade, garnering federal research grants and contracts with the Department of Defense. Craig Olenicek is the company's co-founder and chairman of its board of directors.
The way I look at the Research and Technology Park, there's so many different pieces of it that minimize our risk, such that we maximize our probability of succeeding, maximize our probability of delivering to our customers because of the so-called subsidization of our laboratories, our offices, all of the resources of the university, which we don't have to purchase outright. We can purchase on an hourly basis as needed.
And considering the markets the company targets, driving down exposure to risk is crucial. Whereas most electronic devices rely on silicon chips as their main circuit components, APEI focuses on development of chips and circuits using other materials that are hardier to extreme conditions, whether they end up in the high temperatures of underground mining operations, or jet engines in the sky, or even in the gamma radiation found in space.
Silicon carbide and gallium nitride are known to be more radiation hardened than silicon solutions. So from that point of view, this enables certain systems to be designed and implemented that previously you would never even think about. If silicon can go to 125 degrees C, you wouldn't be thinking of using silicon in smart sensor networks inside a jet turbine engine at 1500 degrees C.
Olenicek says that the electronics they develop can operate reliably at 450 to 500 degrees Celsius enabling sensors to be placed in certain parts of a jet turbine that were never before possible. And doing things that have never been done has garnered attention to APEI. Again, here's Charmella Mounts.
We have some customers, because of our reputation, they come to us because they can't get whatever problem it is to work, and they feel that we have the capability here.
And problem solving is something that Olenichek says is not only inherent in Arkansas Power Electronics International's reputation, but he also credits that attitude to the critical mass of entrepreneurs that fill the park, which he says builds a camaraderie among the various startups.
And I think it's that interaction between and among people who work in these various companies that we find interaction and overlap. And my needs might be something that a partner company can give and so forth. So I think that's also a very interesting piece of the research and technology park, which is this ethos that exists in the park of people having very like mindsets in trying to move forward and advance the state of Arkansas by advancing products and technology.
And as I was repeatedly told, the park's purpose is not only advancing technology development in the state, but it's also meant to keep the talent in Arkansas that makes those technology advances possible.
That story aired in 2013 on Ozarks at Large. We are talking about some of our favorite stories and interviews from the past year during this week that is includes the last couple of days of 2013, the first few of 2014. Now, that highlights one end of the spectrum in technology in Arkansas, the cutting edge. Christina, you work on a story about some of the places in Arkansas that haven't caught up yet.
Right.
And the efforts to help them catch up.
Mm-hmm. Living in Fayetteville, we don't realize that there are a lot of rural areas. I mean, maybe we do realize that, but we just don't think that they don't have the amenities and things, the luxuries that we're used to, like internet. And this is actually a story that I spent probably about a month working on.
According to last spring's TEDx Fayetteville talk by Rebecca Miles and Javier Reyes, 30% of Americans complete a four-year college degree in 4 years. Yet just 20% of Arkansans do the same. And just 14% of Arkansans have a college degree, 34% a high school diploma. More and more people are forced to get college degrees whether they want to or not. It's now the barrier to obtaining most professional careers, says Dr. Rebecca Miles.
If I have children or I live in a small town where I can't move to get a college degree, I'm not able to get that degree that allows me either entry to a job or a better salary to the job that I want to have. Technology allows people, if we put all the pieces together, to stay in their hometown and still get that same college degree without having to move to Fayetteville or wherever else they might want to move. So it allows me to learn, move ahead, keep pace with my peers both locally and nationally if I have access and get the education that I want.
Miles is a management professor at the University of Arkansas. There's also a direct correlation between education and economic development. It starts with education, providing a base for entrepreneurship and setting up new jobs and allowing individuals to recognize opportunities. Dr. Javier Reyes is the Vice Provost for Distance Education at the University of Arkansas's Global Campus.
Being now that we have the technology to disseminate education through online media in a way that it's effective, that has the quality that you want to have, and now we can have the reach that you currently couldn't have with a face-to-face environment. That is what the correlation is. You're going to be able to have a higher number of educated population in order to be able to have a higher impact in economic development. Now, it's not only about the four-year degree. It's not only about the associate's degree. It's also about certificate. It's also about training programs. So that's what I think it's the correlation that exists between more technology, more connectivity, and have a highly educated population.
There is a difference between connectivity and accessibility. Reyes says there are three barriers to accessibility.
Is there no connectivity because the end user doesn't have access to an internet connection, or they have access but they don't have the income to pay for it, or they may have access, the income, but they're not aware of the benefits? So it's about finding which one of these three is really the barrier and why we're not connected when we look at national rankings.
It's different for everybody, and Reyes says that in some places it's a combination of the three. In some areas of Arkansas, say the Delta, where connectivity is low, awareness is low, and incomes are low. It is difficult to raise awareness as to how the internet could be a benefit. For Reyes, awareness is the biggest barrier.
It's about what is the benefit of having an email account? What is the benefit of having the awareness of how to navigate the internet? When you see the kids now, even in the schools, in the K-12 system, what they're learning, how they're learning, how they can, in a day, build a report from a painting that it's at the Louvre in Paris, and you can get a virtual tour of the Louvre online. That kind of creativity, that kind of, it's opening their minds. And if we don't have that in our state, we keep falling behind to create the young minds and create the culture of having more innovation, more technology embedded in our everyday lives.
He says that it cannot be done with just universities. It needs to be a combination of the private sector and the public sector, and not just in higher education. The report card on American education from the American Legislative Exchange Council ranks Arkansas's public schools at 45th in the nation. Governor Mike Beebe sees the relation between connectivity and education, evidenced by the start of a task force, Faster Arkansas, Fast Access for Students, Teachers, and Economic Results. It's a group of business leaders, technical experts, and political experts trying to push forward broader and faster internet access in all of the public schools in Arkansas. Jerry Jones, an executive vice president with Axiom in Little Rock, is chair of the group.
It was our collective belief, certainly the belief of the governor, that even though Arkansas had gotten off to a good start back in 1992, it would fall way behind. And it was time for us not just to catch up, but to get ahead. And so hence he asked me to bring this group together. Hopefully by the end of this calendar year, we will have a set of very, very specific recommendations on the governor's desk to go to the special session of the legislature that's primarily the financial session of the legislature in January and February and adopt whatever changes in Arkansas law need to be adopted.
Jones says Faster Arkansas is looking at the speeds and capacity levels that should be adopted by schools. He referenced a Cisco report that recommends in 5 years, students should have access to a 2 gigabyte per second capacity in order to have a functioning school. He says Arkansas can't do that initially. While there are some small rural districts with no broadband access at all, larger districts don't have sufficient capacity to support all of the needed online usage. Often, not everyone that needs on can get on. It will also be a problem when Common Core standards are enacted next year. Testing will be completed via the internet, and Arkansas will not be able to comply with the standards without more capacity. Faster will start with the schools, but want to make sure that what they do can be utilized by communities, which is where the ER in the name comes from, economic results.
Our strategy is, first, we're going to focus on the school districts and the school buildings, and we're going to make suggestions there, and we're going to try to drive some very, very rapid change there, because we got to catch up. Coming in on top of that is, what can the state of Arkansas do to help make sure that the internet is ubiquitous?
Helping to get internet access to rural citizens is Ron Grigg of Deluxe Information Systems in Springdale. For 11 years, he has been providing broadband through links and towers around the region, sending out 2.5 gigahertz, which is higher than an AM/FM broadcast, from 65 locations such as Mount Kessler, Mount Sequoia, and Robinson Mountain, to about 700 customers who didn't have any other option for internet access.
It's too expensive for Cox or AT&T to run fiber or coax out into a low-density area. And so, they focus on towns and communities, but people that live off out. And I mean, I've got clients that are 5-10 miles away from my towers, and the primary requirement is to have a clear line of sight and be able to see the tower with the antenna they're connecting with. And so I'm not able to reach everybody, but anybody that's got a clear view to one of my tower locations has got the chance of getting some good broadband.
Companies charge customers that want access about $10 per foot of cable that needs to be laid, way out of the budget for most people. Bringing internet to rural customers can be likened to events of 75 to 80 years ago, when homes that never had light were wired for electricity. Here's Dr. Miles and Dr. Reyes.
We did not think that electricity was a public good. And perhaps it's time to think about internet access as a public good.
And the truth is, sometimes we have to understand that the cost of making it available will not necessarily be paid by the kids who are getting access now. But once they're in, the benefit that society and that these areas will see in the coming years, it's what we have to figure out how to do it, how to make sure that we take the return on investment, the present value of that return on investment, and really cost it out today.
That story first aired on Ozarks at Large in 2013. This is a special edition of Ozarks where we can listen again to parts and portions of some of our favorite conversations and stories. Going along with the internet, Christina.
Yes.
Stephanie Schulte, who is a professor at the University of Arkansas this year, had a book published that's kind of about the history of the internet. And it's one of the best reads I've had in a long time. So I invited her to come into the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio. Here's part of that conversation.
A lot of researchers have sort of talked about the internet as having two parents, as having this parent in the military, which, you know, makes a lot of sense because the internet was funded by NASA funding. So the same funding packet that funded NASA funded the internet. And then also its second parent being the counterculture. So the 70s and 80s counterculture, hippies really were the cultural arm of the internet. And War Games really shows you those two sides in a kind of powerful way.
And War Games and then some other images that came up that were often used not just by the entertainment industry, but sometimes the nightly news and the news weeklies showed the protagonists or the people who are with computers as sort of outsiders, messy bedrooms, this sort of idea that not quite could be trusted. Because as you said, computers weren't really in the homes yet, let alone the office.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the computers were mostly used by teenagers in basements playing video games and used for entertainment purposes at that point. And I think that's part of the reason why it was sort of menacing in some ways. We connected it to changing of the guard fears about kids these days, right? And you know, merged those with fears that we had about Cold War, and evils lurking.
And War Games was screened, or at least part of it was screened on the Senate floor?
Yeah, in committee. Yeah, the first legal policies about the internet happened in the wake of that movie, and it was the Computer Fraud Act, which is the policy that was recently used to indict Aaron Swartz, and the senators were responding to a number of hacks that happened, and they actually watched War Games as part of research, which I thought was quite fascinating. That was actually one of the sparks for writing the whole book, was actually making that discovery and realizing that had happened.
And a lot of those policies are still kind of the policies that are on the books now.
Yeah, they are. It was the precedent policy, the very first policy. And really what happened was that, you know, hacking became a problem, and Congress felt that it needed to respond to that problem, and it had a wide array of choices, different ways it could respond. It could respond with punitive action, like jail time and fines.
Some of the legislation that did not come bills was very severe.
Yeah, jail, which involved jail time.
Yeah.
Or it could be as light as an ethics class or something really light. And, you know, I argue that, you know, part of the reason why that legal decision went toward the sort of parental way was because we imagine the internet itself as teenaged and as populated by teenagers. So it was varying layers of teenagerdom.
What was the Internet World's Fair in 1996? What was this? I don't remember this either.
The Internet World's Fair was an international collaboratory event that basically took the idea of the World's Fair and took it online. So countries had representative websites where they placed their most compelling internet artifacts on there. And then citizens also participated, which was sort of a new offering for a World's Fair. And it ended up resulting in a lot of real tangible results. So we got infrastructure got a lot better in the wake of that, kind of the same way that the World's Fairs have rippled through technology in past in their physical forms.
And it really set up this sort of dual way of looking at the internet and the World Wide Web, in that, okay, it's a global community, but it was still seen as a U.S.-based sort of thing because it's happening in Central Park. So there was this sort of, is it global or is it global but with a U.S. leadership?
Yeah, a lot of what I write about in the book is about the ways that American culture has rippled through the internet and the ways that, you know, For example, the United States government has .gov is its domain name. Every other country has .uk for the United Kingdom or .de for Germany, but we're .gov, right? We get to be the universal access. We're the internet's government in some ways. And that's part of because we invented it and began it, although it was international very few years after it was invented, 3 years after it was invented. But we have sort of become the cultural, the dominant cultural power on the internet, and it means Americanness in some ways. And so in that World's Fair in particular, the gateway to the World's Fair was through Central Park, which was, I thought, a fitting metaphor for the ways that it was American and is still imagined as this American thing.
Did you found that the way national and international media look at and described the internet and the World Wide Web to sort of evolve over time, because there slowly becomes this inclusion. And I don't think you could probably find that in the auto industry or something like that. But it is interesting because it's relatively recently to see how quickly we sort of went from articles in Life magazine about the dangers of the teenage hacker to sort of the internet and the web are part of everyday life. And it really, it seems like in the 1990s, explodes in how newspapers and news magazines cover the internet.
Yes, that's the moment when I say it kind of moves out of the teenager's bedroom and into the office. And we start thinking about the internet as something that will help us economically. So we start thinking about it as less of a toy and more of an economic driver or a means to efficiency. And it's also when we start to panic a little bit and start to think about it as a new frontier that we need to settle. So that's when Al Gore famously enters into the conversation in a way that has been terribly mischaracterized, the poor guy. But he, you know, we really start to think about it as the key to the future and the key to our economic future, our social future, and that trend has continued now, and we continue to talk about it that way as this sort of inevitable angel of history that's pulling us forward.
Stephanie Schulte on Ozarks at Large earlier this year. And Antoinette, I want to continue along this line of books mm-hmm. and technology, because those two things were fused in a story you did recently.
Yes. Rhonda Dillard, our underwriting director, actually brought me this book that someone had given to her, and it was written from the perspective of a woman who has autism, which I found fascinating because I feel like there are lots of books out there, you know, maybe more scientific about what autism is or parents dealing with children with autism. But it was just so interesting to me to have someone who has autism to offer their perspective. Now, she is nonverbal and she uses something called facilitated communication. And so it was a really long process of writing this book. But what was interesting is because she's nonverbal, her mother came in and was able to share the story of raising her daughter and also what it was like for her, who's now a grown woman, I think in her 40s, who what it was like for her to, you know, struggle to write the story.
Well, it was very different. I don't know that it was any easier than it is now, but you didn't have access to information. And the professionals in your child's life were not as aware of autism as they are now, or what to do to help children and parents both. Stephanie wasn't actually diagnosed with autism till she was about 17. She was in her late teens. She was undiagnosed. We knew there were difficulties that she was facing. We knew there were delays. She couldn't speak. I mean, lots of things going on. But even though when she was young, we lived in Houston and she had access, we had access to great medical facilities, I guess autism was still at that point where the information wasn't widespread. And so even though she was tested and all these things, they didn't diagnose autism at all, ever. So she went many, many years just sort of without her knowing or us knowing. And when she finally was diagnosed, it was actually here in Fayetteville. And she said it was such a relief. She said, you know, most people don't want a label, but she was relieved to know she wasn't crazy and that there really was a name for what was going on for her. So it was difficult because even though we didn't know she had autism per se, we knew that there were a lot of things she struggled with and things we had no explanation for and no one could explain to us. And so we were very much in the dark. And it was scary. And, and sometimes just really disheartening that we couldn't get answers and couldn't get the help we needed to be better parents and to help her really move on with her life and you know, have a life and learn and do things. So,
what were some of the challenges that you had to deal with? Did she go to public school or?
She did go to public school in Houston. She went to a self-contained classroom at a regular school. When we moved here, that was not available. She went to Sunshine School, which was totally separate and apart. She was one of the first students, though, who did enter the regular schools in Bentonville. There were, I don't remember, two or three students with severe challenges that entered the public school when she would be junior high age. And that was a milestone here, you know, and everywhere, really. Things just weren't done the same. And one of the things she tells people now is that she is angry about the fact she missed out on a lot of learning and that she had to pretty much teach herself or learn in other ways than in a classroom. After high school, she was fortunate enough to go to NWAC and take several classes, and that was exciting, and that really gave her an opportunity she never dreamed she would have, and so that was wonderful.
And somewhere after being diagnosed with autism, I understand you guys learned about facilitated communication?
Yes. In fact, all of it sort of happened in and around the same time frame in her late teens. Facilitated communication was brought to us by a friend of ours who was actually a special education teacher in the Springdale schools. She had gone to Syracuse for continuing education and learned about facilitated communication there and was very excited to bring it back and try it with Stephanie. And there was just instant rapport there, which is somewhat unusual, but it was wonderful that she was able to introduce it to her and then also teach me. And that was just amazing to be able to communicate really for the first time in anything past just real basic, I need, I want stuff. But to have a conversation, you know, that was wonderful. And because of just routine testing with schools and things, she was finally seen by someone who was able to diagnose the autism. So it, I don't know that that really wasn't because of the facilitation. It's just a lot more had learned, and this individual recognized the signs and the behaviors and things that made them believe she had autism.
So how does the facilitated communication work?
It doesn't work the way it looks.
Okay.
It looks like maybe you're trying to help someone, a type or point, but that's really not the way it works. And today, when they teach it, they try to teach people to encourage as much independence as possible. But for example, for Stephanie, I'll just give you an example. She has she can isolate her fingers and all to point to a keyboard, but she has great difficulty with the pressure and with going from letter to letter. So for Stephanie, what is important, and I admit it's less and less as she moves along, but what was important to her, very important to her at the beginning, was that after she touched a letter, you pulled her hand back away from the keyboard and gave her a lot of physical resistance so that she could then manage to touch the next letter. And so even though there was physical contact, the person facilitating isn't doing anything in terms of what's being typed. They're just trying to aid the individual in whatever way is needed so that they can type what they want to say. And the most amazing thing about Stephanie when she started is we realized she had a huge vocabulary and could spell and do all these things when at that point teachers were saying she maybe could read a few sight words and that was it. And so all of a sudden, you know, she's exploding with all this language. It was really amazing.
When you were able to have more of a reciprocal conversation with your daughter, were you surprised to find that she had been able to understand the world around her? Because I feel like oftentimes if someone is nonverbal, you sort of assume that they don't understand what's happening. Not necessarily that they do understand, they just can't communicate that. Were you surprised by that?
Yes and no, mm-hmm. in that I always believed there was a lot more going on in there than Stephanie could get out. For one thing, you could just see it in her eyes and places like, you know, that. And when you're watching a movie, she would laugh before everyone else in the appropriate spot. Or, I mean, you knew she had reciprocal language. How much surprised me. The fact she could read like she did and could spell and do all these things certainly surprised me. But the fact that she understood didn't really surprise me. The depth of her understanding did. But I never doubted she didn't know some language. And one of the things was that she would read, not a lot, but I mean, she could always pick out her name and her sibling's name and different things if there were cards or things around. So I knew she had some reading. It was pretty amazing, though, to learn the extent of it and how intelligent she was and how deep thinking she was. But I guess if you sit around for whatever, 18 years and can't really communicate, a lot's going on in there.
That's a story that first aired on Ozarks at Large in 2013. We're continuing on this Wednesday edition of Ozarks to talk about some of our favorite interviews and stories from the previous 12 months. We'll continue this all week long. Katie Hendrickson, we've been talking about high-tech stuff all this special edition of Ozarks at Large. So tell me about the Trash Can Bandits. Are they high-tech?
They're not high tech. They're a rock band kind of, but they also have a clarinetist. They fuse a lot of different sounds together. But one of my favorite things about being a part of Ozarks at Large is having in studio performances with all sorts of musicians, ranging all types of genres. And I get my own personal performance here, and then I'm allowed to share that performance with all our listeners. So I love that.
This is the Queen of Hearts.
She just don't care. A pretty little girl ain't never seen a thing like you. Cyanide lays on her lips. Steals her breath with the tornado hips. A pretty little girl ain't never seen a thing like you. I said no. No, no, no. Thank you. try. One more try. One more try. One more try. One more try. Yeah. And learn now. Learn now. Learn now. Learn now. And stay away from me. As I know. Learn now. Learn now. And stay away from me. Stay away from me.
Trash Can Bandits in the Furman Garner Performance Studio. Jacqueline Froelich is with us, of course. She's part of the Ozarks at Large staff. Jackie, you did a great story this year. I'm just going to let you explain it.
Thanks, Kyle. President Barack Obama has issued a number of executive orders since he's been president, which is his right as president of the United States. And one of them was astonishing. He announced that the U.S. Department of Homeland Security would stop deporting hundreds of thousands of young people brought here illegally into the United States by their parents. And the undocumented youth were also eligible to apply for what's called Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival status, entitling them, these young people who have been just trying to survive in America, temporary employment authorization cards, driver's license, government IDs, they are cut loose to live the life that they ought to be living. So thousands of these kids in Arkansas are now working, driving, enjoying life under granted as relief under this program. I contacted Maria Reith, who is a immigration rights activist and organizer, noted, who was recently honored at the White House this year in 2013, and she gave me a tip on a young woman in Fort Smith who agreed to talk on the record about her experience as a deferred young individual at her job. And her employer allowed me to go into her workplace and interview her. So she came out of what they call the shadows, and her name's Cindy Perez.
Dean's Carpets, how can I help you?
Cindy Perez answers the phone at Dean's Discount Carpets on Kelly Highway in Fort Smith this morning. She works here full-time in the front office and attends college. But just a year ago, this Northside High School graduate had zero options. Her situation traces back to when her family brought her across the U.S. border from Mexico when she was just a toddler.
My family came to the United States when I was 2 years old. We lived in a small town in the state of Guanajuato. We've lived in Fort Smith, Arkansas since then. They basically came here in search of a better life.
Guanajuato is one of 31 sovereign states comprising the Mexican Republic and is located in central Mexico. Both Cindy's parents are in the process of securing their work visas, and Cindy's two siblings were born here, so are U.S. citizens. But for her, she was undocumented, and things looked bleak. That is until last June, when she heard President Barack Obama announce that hundreds of thousands of undocumented young people like herself could apply for temporary work authorization credentials under the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, DACA for short.
It was the most exciting day of my life. It really was. I thought, yay, finally, I'll be able to get a job, I'll be able to drive, I'll be able to go to school and get my Social Security number and live my life like everybody else.
Although the deferment process is complex and deferments are limited, the family encouraged her to apply right away.
So, yeah, it was available August the 15th, and I submitted my application August the 15th. And in 2 months, I received my work permit in the mail, and I was extremely excited. The next day, I went to the Social Security office where I applied for a Social Security number. And as soon as I got my Social Security number, I went to take my driver's test, and I got my driver's license, and it was on from there.
Cindy had to pay a $465 application fee, plus she had to prove that she's lived in the United States at least 6 years, arriving before her 16th birthday, was born after 1981, was attaining an education or military record, and had no criminal record. It's a lot of paperwork for individuals who are demographically invisible. But as soon as she got her work authorization card?
Oh, not long at all. John told me, as soon as you get your Social Security number, come here and we'll fill out an application.
She's talking about John Paul Dean, her new boss. They met several years ago at Christ the King Catholic Church.
She does a fantastic job.
John Paul Dean inherited the carpet store from his father, who established the business in 1966. And he's made a practice to employ individuals seeking to rebuild their lives. But he had no idea so many undocumented families were living in Arkansas. That is, until a man who spoke no English showed up at his business 5 years ago looking for work.
There was a young lady who came into the store with her father, and she was acting as his translator, and he wanted to have a job working here at the store.
He soon learned the family had no papers. He couldn't hire the father legally, but made the decision, after learning her story, to provide a scholarship to the daughter to attend college. He's helped others as well. John Paul Dean says he's politically independent and not an activist.
However, I have strong views that about things. I think that the immigration laws need to be changed to allow people that are talented and qualified to come in.
Because, he says, the American economy needs people who want to work, especially those who risk their lives crossing the border in search of a job. Cindy Perez, who's turned 20, is working full-time, plus she's enrolled part-time at the University of Arkansas Fort Smith studying accounting. But in 2 years, her special immigration status will expire, nor does it convey a path to lawful permanent resident status or U.S. citizenship.
And after 2 years, we'll be eligible to reapply. And hopefully they will allow us to continue reapplying for it, or actually get some kind of immigration reform going.
Which is currently stalled in Congress, says Maria Reith, co-founder and executive director of the Arkansas United Community Coalition. Reith, who was recently honored by the White House for her work on comprehensive immigration reform, has been encouraging young people across Arkansas to secure DACA status, including Cindy Perez.
Well, for us here in Arkansas, the most recent statistics show that about 3,606 youth from Arkansas have applied for deferred action for childhood arrivals, and approximately 2,760 of those have been approved. Our approval rate for Arkansas is 76.5%, which is in the top third of the national median, a number that we're very proud of. And the states, just to give you a sense of the range of states, there are states where less than 50% are actually getting approved. And what this means is that this program really is addressing a very tangible need for Arkansas youth and benefiting directly our state in a very real way. That said, we believe that there are still about 9,000 eligible youth for DACA, some not quite as of yet. There's about 2,000 to 3,000 of those that have yet to hit the 15-age minimum, but will be eligible within the next year.
Of the estimated 11 million undocumented immigrants in the United States, as many as 2 million are young people. In Arkansas, Mireya Reith has been working in coalition with other advocates to locate and assist them in the complex application process for deferment.
Where youth could connect with attorneys and train volunteers to get support. We also have to applaud really Catholic Charities, Arkansas Justice for Our Neighbors, Arkansas Coalition for Dream, amongst other nonprofits that supported that effort.
And although there's a long way to go, Reith says the success stories are really something.
We've been really excited to see a full range of employment being extended to our DACA youth at restaurants, or within the food industry. But then we've seen several of our youth actually be very quickly picked up by very specialized industries, such as doctors, psychologists, businesses, corporations, because they have long had a shortage of bilingual individuals, talented individuals.
And for Cindy Perez, her deferment is also a political action, allowing her to step further out of the shadows as a, quote, dreamer, one who supports comprehensive immigration reform for undocumented youth.
Right now, we're working towards informing our community of immigrant rights, and also we have a couple of projects where we want to get the Hispanic community more involved in education.
And now, with her changed status, Cindy Perez plans to settle in Fort Smith.
My dream is to become an accountant and have several rental properties.
And she'll likely get an excellent deal on flooring.
That story aired earlier this year on Ozarks at Large. Tomorrow we're going to have some more of our favorites as we move a little bit deeper into 2014. In a moment, music from Mary Gaucher, who was in Northwest Arkansas to perform at the Roots Festival, but then also performed live when we did the live edition of Tales from the South. And that was a packed house. All right, we're going to go out with Mary Gaucher. Thanks, everyone. Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF.
Steam train Maury died last night. His wife Wanda by his side. He caught the westbound out of here. Hopped the high irons to the by and by. They say he jumped 1,000 trains. Rode 1,000,000 miles for free. Helped out at VA hospitals and penitentiaries. Dandy Dave and Rusty Nails and Sweet Lady Sugarcane. Deadeye Kate and the Baloney Kid raise a cup tonight in old steam train's name. Senators and congressmen, puppets on a string. Among windswept vagabonds, steam train was the king. The last. Of the Hobo Kings. He was the last of the Hobo Kings. Drink and wander around.